welcome to the Innovation Forum podcast for Friday, 2nd of October, with me, Ian Welsh. Earlier this week, I caught up with Peter Stanbury, who is leading on a new research group for Innovation Forum, investigating challenges for smallholder farming communities and some of the business-led solutions that can help. We talked about some of the group's initial findings and how the crucial buyer-supplier relationships are evolving. Plus, there's another chance to hear an interview I did with Fairtrade America's Stephanie Westell a few months ago about her work in cocoa supply chains, helping to ensure long-term security of supply. First up, though, is the usual roundup of some sustainable business news. Plastic bottle deposit return schemes have been called for across Europe by a group of leading drinks brands and companies, including Coca-Cola, PepsiCo, Danone, Nestle and Red Bull. Via the European Federation of Bottled Waters and the European Soft Drinks Group, UNSDA, the companies argue the case for deposit return schemes driving recycling rates towards the EU's target of 90% as set out in the Single-Use Plastic Directive. The industry has for some time argued that only through deposit return schemes can recycling of PET plastic bottles reach this sort of level. 8 European nations already have deposit return schemes in place, and France, Spain and Belgium are under pressure to join in. Such schemes are not universally popular, of course. Detractors point out that in areas with domestic curbside recycling, removing PET plastic from the stream takes away the most valuable recyclate, affecting the commercial viability of the recycling scheme overall. If one thing is certain, it's that the pros and cons of DRS is a debate that is set to run for some time. The international rubber sector has taken a step towards a more sustainable future with a new framework from the Global Platform for Natural Sustainable Rubber, including commitments on deforestation and human rights. The platform was set up in 2018 and has 90 members, including tire companies, representatives of the automotive sector, as well as rubber growers. It says that it represents around half the rubber sector by volume. While many high-profile brands, including tyre manufacturers and car makers, have had sustainable rubber commitments in place for some time, the industry as a whole has been unregulated, with a number of emerging environmental and social challenges unchecked. Deforestation is a significant risk, with some studies suggesting that the rubber sector would account for 5 million hectares of forest destruction by 2024 under business-as-usual practices. Indigenous peoples have been forced off their traditional lands to make way for plantations, and exploited migrant labour has been involved in rubber's harvesting. Members of the platform will have a 6-month period to work out how they will implement the framework in their operations and supply chains. Smallholder farmers, who make up 85% of rubber producers, will be involved, and lessons learned by other tropical commodities, such as palm oil, will be taken into account over the coming months. Companies subject to the UK's Modern Slavery Act face a tightening of their reporting requirements. From 2021, any business with a UK turnover of £36 million or more will have to publish their modern slavery statements on a new online reporting platform. Until now, these statements, which contain detail of the company's modern slavery risks and what they are doing about them, have merely had to be linked to the business's homepage and have in many cases been hard to find. More regular updates of what companies are doing will be required, with civil penalties for non-compliance to be introduced. It's not yet clear what these will be, but the move does represent a significant change from the existing name and shame approach. Innovation Forum's 2020 Future of Plastics Conference is rapidly approaching. It will be held via our interactive online platform over 3 days from 20th to 22nd of October. Among the expert panellists already confirmed are representatives of Coca-Cola European Partners, Dow Chemical Company, Tesco, Anheuser-Busch InBev and Greenpeace. And the first week of November this year sees Innovation Forum's Sustainable Landscapes and Commodities event. This will include a series of focused interactive workshops around an extended conference over 3 days from the 3rd to the 5th of November. Already signed up to take part are senior representatives from Sime Darby, April, Tate & Lyle, WWF, Burger King and the Consumer Goods Forum. All details are on innovationforum.co.uk. And we have the second in our pre-event workshops, free for all signed up delegates, coming up next week on the 8th of October, when we will consider the next generation of smallholder farmers and what will be required to empower them. There's still time to sign up for the November event now to allow you to participate in the workshop next week. Coming up now is another chance to hear an interview I recorded around Innovation Forum's Future of Food conference series in the spring with Fairtrade America's Development Manager for Sustainability and Partnerships, Stephanie Westell. We talked primarily about her work in the cocoa sector. We're going to be talking a little bit about Fairtrade America's work in cocoa supply chains, but first of all, Stephanie, why don't you introduce yourself and put in context what you do at Fairtrade America and your work on cocoa?
So I work in partnerships, and what that really means is that I am the connector between the brands, the traders, and fair trade ingredients for producers. So I am the person who maybe a brand or a trader is interested in having a look at their supply chain, looking for areas to improve upon in sustainability. And I help make those connections. And then also if a brand wants to become a full partner and have the fair trade label put on their products, I help them go through certification through our sister organization called FlowCert. And then as well as the team of people I work with, we help launch the product into the market.
What are the emerging social challenges in the cocoa supply chains that you work in at the moment?
Emerging social challenges, they've been there actually quite for some time. But unfortunately, during this pandemic, issues like widespread poverty, gender inequality, and child labor are actually quite persistent and increasing in certain areas of the world. Even before the pandemic hit, the chocolate industry is worth quite nearly at $150 billion. And despite this fact, many cocoa farmers in West Africa are still living in poverty and unable to pay for essential items like food or sending their children to school or to buy medicine if they fall sick. Unfortunately, with poverty, it always increases child labor and gender equality throughout the world. An example of this is in Cote d'Ivoire. Women cocoa farmers carry about like 2/3 of the work, yet they're estimated to earn just 21% of the income generated at the farm. And an example from Ghana, female head of households earn around 1/3 less of the income than male head of households. Yet women in cocoa carry a lot of the burden. They're working in the fields, they look after the children, they're carrying water amongst other tasks, bringing the crop to market, and they often have fewer rights than men, which is a huge social challenge because it's embedded in the culture. And at Fair Trade, we're really trying to change this for the better in a number of ways. One of our top priorities is helping cocoa farmers in communities fight poverty, which is a root of the problem, we believe, and empowering women farmers to be business owners and leaders in their cooperatives. And a really cool pilot that we had a few years ago and is going very well is Fair Trade's Women's School of Leadership, which was started in West Africa. It really tries to close that gender gap by supporting women to learn business, negotiation skills, and finance skills through the program.
Let's come back to some of those broader social challenges in a bit. What about environmental challenges then for cocoa supply chains?
We have two very large issues in cocoa in both Latin America and West Africa, and those are deforestation and climate change. Referring back to deforestation, more than 80% of the Ivorian rainforest has already been lost over the past 50 years, and unfortunately, a large portion of this loss is due to cocoa. There's been a mentality for a slash and burn type of crop. So it's a single plot which has cocoa, but many studies actually show that the cocoa plant thrives when it's planted in a mixed plot with larger trees for shade. And a lot of times this is referred to as agroforestry. And we do have a couple of pilot programs in Ghana with this right now. But an evolving issue with this is that when you're changing a plot from a single plot over to a multi-plot crop or agroforestry, in some cases, it takes a lot of time. And so that forest that was lost over the past few decades, it's going to take time to reforest that. It's a very hostile choice for farmers. Do I feed my family or do I leave the forest untouched? And then moving over to climate change, with higher temperatures, drought, floods, extreme weather, sometimes even crop diseases, they can really threaten the livelihoods and food security of so many supply chains, not just in cocoa. And then it's often that we see that the people who have the lowest carbon footprint are the ones who are actually hit the hardest. Who are usually at the end of the supply chain. And a lot of these producers are struggling with loss of land, crops, and livelihoods with the extreme weather and rising temperatures. And then it does, in some areas of the world, growing seasons are becoming much shorter. They're varying temperatures. While at the same time, consumers and retailers and traders across the world are increasing their carbon footprint, we really need to come together and find some resilience in this. And we started a program a few years ago. It's called the Fair Trade Carbon Credits. While we are offsetting our carbon with a partnership with Gold Standard, which not only enables farming communities to benefit from the carbon finance itself, the projects that they set up are covered through this. And in addition, they can actually use the credits sold to invest in adaptation and different crop mitigation as well.
And it strikes me that all these environmental issues link right in with the economic challenges as well, because so many of the, as you say, the impacts of climate change are impacting on farmers and impacting on farmer livelihoods. So what are you specifically seeing in terms of emerging economic challenges for cocoa supply chains?
They're all very much interlinked. Global cocoa prices are unsustainably at low levels. Many cocoa farmers across the world, they still earn less than a dollar a day. Not only is this not sustainable, it doesn't even cover the costs of production. And while some might argue that we should just let the market decide the price and have no interventions, I personally just can't agree to this statement. Because if a chocolate company wants a future, that future has to include future generations of farmers and future generations of people involved in the cocoa industry. And at this point in time, why would future generations want to be part of the cultivation of cocoa if they're not even sustainably compensated for their work or cover the costs of production? At Fair Trade, we are the only cocoa certification to focus on price within cocoa. Within the fair trade system, we do believe that you do need some financial interventions to make true impact. And so with the system, we do provide two interventions. One is a price premium and a price floor, or often referred to in many media articles as the minimum price that people pay for fair trade cocoa. And last year, we actually raised the fair trade minimum price for conventional cocoa by 20%, which equates to about $2,400 per metric ton, and that's US dollars. And so this price really acts as a safety net for farmers when the market price does fall below the average cost of production. And then in addition, what's unique about fair trade is that cooperatives that are selling under fair trade terms, they also receive a fair trade premium, which they reinvest into projects such as improving farming methods, building schools, improving healthcare. But it can also be used as a cash payment. There's a lot of issues within cocoa, and environmental being one of them. And if your harvest season is getting cut, that means less cocoa for you. And sometimes that premium is needed to be a cash payment to farmers when sometimes the season just doesn't hold up as they thought it would. And that also went up by 20% last year as well. We have some really strong leader brands within our system, and several of them have actually done some pilot programs with us for living income pilots. A lot of consumers know the name Tony's Chocolonely in both Europe and here in the U.S. They're one of the leaders in this, as well as a chocolate company called Belvis. Belvis does some really great chocolate bark, as well as some bars I know that they sell in the U.K. And then the additional partner that has been involved in some living income projects on the ground is Oxfam Fairtrade, which they have some consumer product goods in Europe. They haven't made their way over to the U.S. yet. But I'm super excited that we did get some wonderful news a few weeks ago that one of the U.S. retailer has signed on to do a living income project. Not allowed to say who yet, but I will definitely send you who's going to be coming on for that, because it's super exciting that we're going to have the first retailer here in the U.S. have a living income chocolate.
It all strikes me as a bit ironic that on the one hand, cocoa farmers produce a crop that's in high demand. In fact, many brands are concerned about ensuring security of supply because there is a potential for farmers are getting older and new generations aren't coming through. But at the same time, whilst there's a question mark over future supply, the market doesn't provide a sufficient income to cover the costs of producing the crop. It's a very strange situation. And one, of course, is really risky for brands that want chocolate because there's the risk of the entire market just disappearing if the farms aren't viable financially. Can we talk a little bit more about agroforestry? You mentioned earlier on. How do you go about persuading farmers to introduce different crops, to introduce shade crops, for example, for cocoa?
I think that in the past, I'll go through the things that haven't worked first. And I think when it comes from somebody who doesn't even live in the country or maybe sits on like a sustainability piece of the brand or in some cases a nonprofit, if you're always feeding information down to the farm and never spending time there, it's very hard to take people seriously because it's a long-term project. It's costly. Agroforestry is great, but people don't understand how much time and money goes into projects like that. And they kind of expect the farmers to quote unquote do the right thing. But when you have families to feed and there's healthy soil, it is healthy soil when you slash and burn. It's just not long-term. It has to come from a producer network leadership, I think. And the farmers have to buy into this. And also they have to understand why and see projects that have worked. Because if you always just say the what ifs or projects or examples that maybe can't clearly be explained, I don't know if I would buy into that as well. The project that we're doing in Ghana really came from leadership at the particular cooperative. And we also had a beautiful story in Costa Rica, actually, with one of our organic farming groups one of their leaders, he was incredible. He would just go on YouTube, look up all of these different agroforestry models. He did some grafting models as well. And he would just go around to his farmers and tell them what he learned. And he set up a nursery for everybody and did it with his own time. And I think that those are the stories that other farmers need to hear. And it's our responsibility as a system to get those stories out to the right people.
So it's ultimately, I guess, it comes down for cocoa supply chains. The biggest challenge really is around farm incomes, and brands and chocolate companies really need to be thinking about, how do I ensure that my suppliers are getting a better income? And is that really what it comes down to?
In all honesty, like, if I'm not getting paid enough for my job and I can't live, like, I don't think that I would keep it. And that's just the reality of it. And if you're not getting a fair wage, especially when you have children, I just couldn't imagine having to make those choices.
What have you learned from your work in cocoa supply chains that you apply to other sectors?
I guess I should have mentioned this in the beginning. I do work in several other supply chains. I work in cane sugar, nuts, spices, and honey. I've realized that my work in cocoa, the way that we're able to scale projects and be open communicators throughout the system, and I do mean the fair trade system, because there are 15 other offices, as well as 3 producer networks and 1.7 million farmers. Having an open communication dialogue between all stakeholders in cocoa has really taught me that that's really what's needed. I'm one person in a very large and complex system. So having open communication with internal, external stakeholders can really amount to immense change. And an example of this work in cocoa was the Fairtrade Women's Leadership School in West Africa. So the program started with one of our partners doing a donation and using this as a pilot project. So it started with 22 participants within like 7 cooperatives, and it just skyrocketed. It was amazing. Those participants, their end project for the school, they got to present at the World Cocoa Conference in Brazil 2 years ago. So that was just incredible. It was actually producer-led. And then we got more funding, and this year we got up to 40 participants. And I'm really happy to announce that we did get additional funding and we got producer buy-in. So next year we're going to have 100 participants in the leadership program, which is going to cover, I think, almost 20 different producer groups. So just to have that amount of growth in that little of time, and it really took everybody, the whole system, to really be open communicators and to also work together to find funding.
How has the World Cocoa Federation's Cocoa in the Forest initiative helped you and others in your work with farmers around income?
So I can really talk about the brand side and how it's helped us with brands, where the farmer side, that would be more of where my colleagues in Bonn, Germany sit. They work more with implementation on that. But I think that for us, it's just awareness. I think sometimes, like, when you're deep dive into your own job, maybe you don't realize that 80% of the ivory forest is gone. And so I think awareness and having multi-stakeholder meetings about that, involving us as NGOs, we've met with the State Department before as well, with the World Cocoa Foundation, having these multi-stakeholder meetings where you can really have a deeper dive into what it means for brands that they need to get involved, because it's the sustainability and the longevity of their supply chain that's at risk.
What do you think are the keys, perhaps beyond simple economics, that are going to be necessary for smallholder-based producer communities to be viable in the future? Is there more beyond the simple economics of the situation?
Yes, I think that there's 2 main changes that need to happen, and they're quite big and tough changes. The first needs to change from consumers. Consumers vote every day with their dollars, and consumers really need to increase their support to companies that are making the steps to make sustainable and regenerative supply chains. And then the second change that I really see that the cocoa industry needs, a complete shift of thought. We need to look at the actors in the cocoa supply community instead of a supply chain. And that's a really tough ask, because most companies are required to increase profits year over year, and they will choose profits over people. But however, everything in this industry is interconnected. It's not linear. Without the future of cocoa beans being sustainable, there is no chocolate.
That's a very good point, isn't it? It does all have to come together, as we referred to earlier. For there to be a viable future for the industry, then there needs to be a bit of a shift in terms of how value chains work. As part of Innovation Forum's ongoing work on the future of smallholder farming communities, we have convened a research group examining the challenges for farmers and trying to find some of the long-term solutions that can work. Earlier this week, I caught up with Dr. Peter Stanbury, Senior Associate at Innovation Forum, who is leading this work and who shared some of the group's emerging conclusions. Peter, you've been leading a research group designed to drill down into the challenges for smallholder farmers and their communities and looking for some business-led solutions. Can you outline some of the reasons the group was set up, who's involved in the group, and what questions in particular that you're investigating?
The research group emerged from the Landscapes Conference last autumn, when it was apparent that the sort of approach to dealing with smallholder farmers, which worked on the basis of certification and standards, had slightly sort of run into the sand, still relevant, but more was needed, and that we needed to see smallholder farmer supply chains more in context. And various conversations we had with a number of organisations afterwards led us to realise that there were sort of two areas that needed to be addressed. The first is to try and take learnings from across different supply chains. What tends to happen at the moment is palm people talk to palm people, cocoa people talk to cocoa people, and never the twain shall meet. So what we were trying to do is to share learnings between different supply chains. And then the second aspect is to see those farmers more in their context, to try and understand the sort of social, political, economic dynamics, the context in which those farmer supply chains operate. And that's what we're doing. We have six member organisations on board. I'm always going to forget one. So Nestle, Cotton Connect, Golden Agri, the Clinton Development Initiative, Collier ACP, and the German government, GIZ. See, I remembered them. That's quite good going. Those organisations cover a wide range of supply chains. They are different types of organisations. What we've been doing is a series of interviews with key people from within each of those organisations. I think I've done sort of 60 or so interviews so far, and also a fairly significant literature review. And the idea is to come up with some really clear recommendations for what does best practice look like. So rather than it just being derived from one or other supply chain, from all supply chains or many and very different types of organisations.
What are the challenges that stood out for you?
I think when we started, we assumed that effectively the argument we were saying is that there's a jigsaw puzzle and everyone's got different bits of the jigsaw. And the picture on that jigsaw puzzle is a bunch of smallholder farmers. I think what's become really clear is that actually we know quite a lot about smallholder farmers and what the challenges are in relation to them and what works in addressing those challenges. There's quite a high degree of commonality across different supply chains. What is missing is insight into what happens thereafter, what happens further downstream in the supply chain. So what, for example, happens between farm gate and the dock? There's an awful lot of opacity around that. Then you get into issues of, it's all very well for companies to make commitments around carbon emissions or sustainability, but the implications that that has for the way in which not just part of an organization works, but the whole company. And also issues to do with engagement with government, both at origin country level, but also internationally. So the key thing that stood out so far is when it comes to farmers themselves, we know quite a lot. It's the rest of that big equation that we know much, much less about.
Anything that's taken you by surprise?
The scale of the challenge in a number of areas. First of all, just sheer scale. There are something like an estimated 570 million smallholder farmers in the world. And whilst sustainability projects have reached a large number of farmers, what's going on so far is really a drop in the ocean. And so a real challenge is how do we bring all of this to scale? Secondly, another issue is where you've got some real lacunas, some real gaps in understanding what goes on. So for example, take the discussion last year about the living income differential in the cocoa market in Ghana and Cote d'Ivoire. When you actually start to dig down into that, you realize that's a highly problematic issue, almost certainly won't address the issue and could itself cause a number of other challenges. But then I suppose thirdly, there's the whole question around how do we do supply chains? How consistent are commodity spot markets and long international supply chains with sustainability? If you've got one cocoa bean that has been produced sustainably, another that hasn't, the commodity markets value those exactly the same thing. That's an inconsistency which will need to be addressed. I realize that's a significant and global challenge. But if what we're trying to do is to develop durable smallholder supply chains, these are some of the questions that we are going to need to answer.
Do you have any early conclusions that you can share? And I know you're midway through the process, but what are the conclusions that are emerging from the research?
Well, we've talked a lot, or we've written in Innovation Forum quite a lot about what we've called collaborative development governance, the idea that there's a need for much more collaboration between different sorts of organisations. And I think what we're beginning to see through the research is some really concrete illustrations of how that might work. So if you take even at a reasonably local level with a supply chain, at the moment, you could well have two or three different company sustainability projects working with the same group of farmers. You know, one might be working with them on, I don't know, horticulture, another might be working with them on coffee, but those don't join up. You may well have government extension workers who are also seeking to work with those farmers. They're not joined up. You might have development projects run by international agencies like, you know, the World Bank, GIZ, working with the farmers or a similar group of farmers. That's not all joined up. So even at that local level, you don't get a join up between what goes on. So at the very least, that's a waste of resource. At the worst, it may well mean that you're confusing farmers. Even at that very, very basic level, collaboration to come up with a shared view of what the problem is and what are we going to do about it, I think is very important. That's just at that local level. I think also if you then go to the country level of origin countries, I think there are key issues around how to support those governments in properly resourcing their agricultural interventions. Quite a lot of the people I've interviewed have said that many of the developing countries they work with have set regulation, but with absolutely no ability to be able to deliver on that. Companies slightly find themselves in the position of having to find themselves doing what the government itself should be doing. So how can we join up that? How can we join up perhaps international development assistance to work with some of these countries to help improve what they do in relation to their farmers? What we want to try and do, we're publishing an interim report in the next month. And I think what we'll want to try and do is to draw out some really concrete examples of what that might need to look like at different stages of the supply chain process.
What examples then of this regulation without implementation problem do you think are the most important? You know, this has been around for some time, and it's obviously concerning that it feels that it's still at, you know, a very early stage. So what examples can you share of the, you know, regulation without implementation problem?
Well, I mean, an obvious one is not sufficiently resourcing extension workers. You know, I've myself been in a situation where I was working on a development project, and we were driving, this was in Tanzania, we were driving up into the fields, and the government extension workers hopped a lift in our car because they didn't have transport. And that's not an unusual situation. Various people I've interviewed have told similar stories that you don't have, in many countries, properly resourced extension workers. So theoretically, these are the people who are supposed to be mandated by the government to work with smallholder farmers, but they don't have the resource to do so. So I think even at that very basic level, you've got a big gap between what governments say they want to do and what they do. In other places, there's also examples of where governments want farmers to come together into cooperatives, but don't provide any sort of structured regulatory framework to make that happen. Organizations helping farmers form cooperatives and the cooperatives themselves find themselves slightly sort of wallowing in an unclear legal situation.
How do you think the company-farm relationship is going to change then? And is there a role of technology? Technology is seen so much as the solution to all ills, but how do you see technology really impacting the company-farmer relationship?
I'll start with the company-farmer relationship bit first and then come to the tech bit. It's difficult to escape the conclusion that if commitments being made to sustainability are genuine and are to be delivered, that company-farmer relationship needs to change fundamentally. At the moment, there really isn't a company-farmer relationship in most cases. You have companies buy largely on spot markets, and fine, many companies now have projects working with farmers, but the relationship between farmers and companies is very remote. There may be very many intermediaries in the chain between the company and the farmer. And what that tends to mean is that farmers don't have visibility what they're going to be selling next season. They're poor anyway, so can't really invest. They can't afford for a crop to fail or afford for a crop to not be sold. Examples where that relationship has become closer demonstrate how co-investment by companies with farmers into new equipment, new technologies, new crops, new seed types, and so on. That is a fundamental game changer in terms of how these farmers can operate. If those commitments are to be made to work, then that relationship has to become much, much closer. Interestingly, when it comes to technology, I think it has a role. I'm not sure that it is, in any sense, a magic bullet. I mean, a number of the conversations I've had said that sometimes technology gives the impression of there being a clear answer when actually things are much more complicated. And I think one of the things that we're trying to do with this project is to bring in sort of more of a social science approach, you know, political economy, development economics. And I think understanding some of those societal challenges are at least as important as what technology can do. I'm not saying that technology doesn't have a role, but I think it needs to be balanced alongside building genuine relationships on a human basis with these farmers. Technology can be an adjunct to that, but I don't see it as an answer in itself.
What do you think are going to be the kind of emerging challenges for smallholder and smallholder communities looking forwards?
The obvious challenge is just making the numbers add up. I was very struck by one interviewee who said, we've worked and worked with many of our smallholder farmers to eke out every bit of increased profitability and productivity we can, but it's still not enough. Of the 570 million or so smallholder farmers around the world, about 450 million of them farm on less than 2 hectares. And that unit size is likely to get smaller as populations grow, land gets divided up between the children of the family. It's difficult to see how that model can be sustained. How we shift to something of a more rounded rural agricultural economy is obviously a huge question because it begs a whole bunch of challenges around land tenure, social structures, migration to cities, all of those sorts of things. But it's difficult to see how that can be avoided simply because of the scale of the challenge and how that situation is going to develop as an inevitable consequence of population growth. So I think there's some fairly fundamental challenges which are a lot more complicated and will require a lot more thought and collaboration. However great what's happened so far is, there's several gears that we've got to go up through. This is not just a technocratic question of helping farmers select better seedlings or seeds. It's not just a technocratic question of helping them improve their farming techniques. All of that's very important. There's a need to go much, much further if genuinely we are to get sustainable, durable, smallholder commodity supply chains.
Well, thanks, Peter. It's clear that, as ever, there's still a long way to go. And it's a bit like the proverbial onion. The moment you unpick the, unpeel it, and there's always more challenges underneath. Thanks very much for sharing some of your insights from your research. Dr. Peter Sanbury, a pleasure as ever.
Ian, as ever, a pleasure to talk to you.
You might be interested to know that Innovation Forum plans to convene a similar research group for the apparel sector. If you're interested in getting involved, do get in touch. And as ever, there's plenty more insight and analysis available on innovationforum.co.uk, including the usual audio, interviews and podcasts. But that's all for now. I've been Welsh, and I'll be back next week.